Up next, just in time for Halloween, we get an underreported update on bats in the United States and whether they're still being threatened by white nose syndrome. And another reminder about our next Political Projections film screening, which takes place on Monday, November 3rd, the day before Election Day. And we hope you'll join us and get ready for Election Day at Galapagos in Dumbo. We'll have a special cocktail hour at 6 p.m., and then we'll watch Recount about a previous election at 7 p.m. You can meet other listeners, have a drink or two, and also watch a good movie. RSVP soon, and find out how on our show page at WNYC.org.
WNYC support comes from National Research Alliance, dedicated to research and development, training and consumer education for the advancements of today's modern oil heat. More information at oilheatamerica.com. NYTimes.com, providing continuous coverage of the U.S. presidential election. Live blogging and videos from the campaign trail, interactive maps of key states, and more are now on NYTimes.com. The IFPDA Print Fair, an international art fair for prints, from old master to contemporary artists, today at the Park Avenue Armory at 67th Street. Information at printfair.com.
Today on Soundcheck, neurologist Oliver Sacks talks about how people with autism respond to music, and an indie rock songwriter struggles to understand the father he barely knew and his influential theory of quantum mechanics. That's coming up at 2 on 93.9 FM WNYC. Bats are not only an iconic symbol of Halloween, and I gather Batman costumes are hot this year, but bats are also a key part of the ecosystem. Earlier this year, we broadcast an underreported segment on the white nose syndrome that's been threatening bat populations. And with me now for an update on that is ecologist and bat expert Merlin Tuttle, founder of Bat Conservation International. Welcome to our show.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
What are the symptoms of white nose syndrome besides the fuzzy white fungus on the bat's noses?
Well, this is really a mystery killer. We still don't have a really good cause identified. We're making progress. The white fungus that appears not just on the nose but on the bat's membranes, wing membranes, arms, ears, it is something that usually doesn't seem to cause, you know, fungi don't usually cause the death of animals. They may cause us discomfort, but they don't kill us. But this is called white nose syndrome because the fungus is so characteristic that forms on their faces when they're nearing death. Now, we don't know yet whether this is a symptom of some other problem and the fungus simply attacks after their immune system has been compromised by another pathogen or a toxicant, or environmental pollution, climatic change, or other things. But there's more and more evidence suggesting that the fungus may itself be lethal to the bats. Now,
is this a fungus we have seen elsewhere?
Well, there is some evidence that there may be a similar fungus in Europe, but in Europe it has never been known to kill large numbers of bats. And one of the things that American scientists are scrambling to do right now is to get samples from Europe to see if this is the same fungus that's in Europe. It may be something that evolved in the bats in Europe are over long periods of time able to resist it. This could be something that's been in the United States all along. It may be common and widespread, and it just may not have been discovered before because the bats didn't succumb to it. You know, we have all kinds of problems with mass die-offs of everything from honeybees to frogs. And a lot of these things may be related to what we're doing to the environment and may be sending us signals no less than the old canary in the coal mine. And so
we're making these, the bees and the frogs and the bats, vulnerable to something that they might not have been vulnerable to in the past.
Exactly. So we're not sure if this is a new pathogen that just got introduced to the United States And if that's the case, it may prove devastating before we can do much about it. If it's something that's been here all along and something we're doing is making the animals more vulnerable, then we have a fighting chance to do something about it. And we're in a real scramble now to get to the bottom of this. We organized a major national meeting in Albany, New York last June, where we brought top scientists and wildlife managers from all over the U.S. to develop a strategy through Bat Conservation International. We've been funding emergency research efforts, and we are making progress. We should know a lot more by the end of this winter, but given the numbers of bats that are believed to have died last winter, it's very frightening to think how many more could die this winter before we even have a handle on the cause.
Well, when we talk about bats, we're talking about certain species of bats, aren't we? There's a wide range of bat species.
There are almost a quarter of the world's mammals are bats, more than 1,100 species. They're found in all but the most remote desert and polar regions, and we have about 46 species in the United States. White nose syndrome has only affected six so far, but among those six, especially the little brown bat, which is a very ecologically important species of the northern half of the United States and southern Canada, is its populations are being devastated. Up to 90% and 100% of some populations, hibernating populations, appear to have already been killed.
What about the bats in your area, Austin, Texas, or Carlsbad, which has this celebrated bat population that people actually sit and in a special stadium and wait for the bats to emerge?
We're guardedly optimistic about our most abundant bats, the free-tailed bats, because they don't hibernate. This fungus seems to be very close. If the fungus is the primary problem, the fungus itself that's been identified on the bats grows in very cold environments where the bats hibernate. And since our free-tailed bats don't hibernate, we're not as concerned that it could harm them, but we really don't know, and it could be devastating if it did. Pay attention to the fact that just the bats in Bracken Cave alone, where we protect 20 million bats, eat 200 tons of insects a night, and that a large proportion of those insects are among our most costly crop pests, that cost $1 billion a year in crop losses. And we know that these bats play measurable, demonstrable roles in saving millions of dollars to farmers.
You've talked about a recent case in San Antonio where bats attacked a swarm of moths that had moved into the region.
Well, each spring we have huge moth migrations that come into southern Texas from Mexico and Central America, and they hopscotch all across the U.S. clear up into Canada. They'll land on say corn crop, lay eggs, and then in a few weeks that cycle completes and you have another moth migration that migrates another 500 miles or so north. And so they just follow the seasons from early spring on up through early fall, and then they migrate back. And our bats here in Texas are consuming literally billions of those moths in single nights as they migrate into the United States in spring. And just one female moth can carry 1,000 eggs. That means that if a bat eats only 20 moths, that's potentially 20,000 eggs not laid on an American crop. And far less than that could force a cotton grower in Texas to spray 2 to 3 acres of cotton with pesticides that not only are costly for the farmer, but end up polluting our environment and threatening our health.
Now, we talked about this white nose problem affecting mostly bats in the Northeast, although I gather it's been spreading into the Midwest. Is it only bats that live in close quarters in caves, as you said, cold caves? What about urban bats? Aren't there lots of bats here in New York City in Central Park, Prospect Park, and other parts of New York? Do they have access to caves?
Yes, they do. Let's get one thing clear. We have a wide variety of kinds of bats. Some migrate. Many of your bats from the state of New York migrate south and then still hibernate. They simply go to warmer climates, and for example, your red bats, which are one of your most abundant bats in the state of New York, they'll fly farther south, and then they'll burrow into leaf litter and hibernate literally down under the dead leaves on the ground in the wintertime. And then you have big brown bats that are so cold resistant, they appear to probably create some kind of antifreeze-like substance in their blood in the winter to keep them from freezing in a manner that would kill them. And they can hibernate at sub-freezing body temperatures. And so they can stay in New York and just move into deep rock crevices or under bark of trees or into old buildings and hibernate right there without even having to find a cave or move south. Then you also have bats that, like the little brown bat, which is a very important bat ecologically in the state of New York, this bat would have to migrate to find a cave to hibernate in. And it doesn't necessarily go south. It may very well have to go north to find the cave it needs. But it needs a very specific type of cave environment that is cold but doesn't freeze, and enables the bat to drop into deep torpor, which we call hibernation. The bat may have only one bout of breathing every 45 minutes or so.
Really? They take one breath every 45 minutes?
May take several in a row, but just one bout of breathing in that amount of time. And the metabolic rate goes so low that the bat can actually survive up to 8 months on stored fat reserves. And what's happening with this white nose syndrome is that the bats are running out of fat reserves in midwinter and having to emerge because they're starving, and then they freeze to death.
But I haven't heard about a lot of white nose syndrome in New York City. Am I just not hearing about it, or have urban bats been escaping this problem?
No, urban bats aren't escaping it. What's happening is your urban bats are migrating up to 200 and 300 miles away to find caves or abandoned mines where they can hibernate. And the white nose syndrome is seen by researchers, well, and by the public also, who happen to live near these caves or mines. When the bats start emerging by the thousands in the middle of the winter and dying rather conspicuously, that attracts attention. But those bats may very well live in New York City in the summertime. They just have to migrate back, but they won't once they die, you know, contract white nose syndrome and come out prematurely.
So how serious a threat is this? Is it likely that we'll see a number of bat species go extinct?
Well, it's premature to postulate that far down the line, but let me just point out that this is by far the worst die-off of bats that's ever been recorded in human history. Biologists on the ground have estimated that literally hundreds of thousands are dying just in the core area in the Northeast. Now, that's just last winter. We don't know for sure how many really died until they fail to come back the next winter because the counts are done in their hibernating sites. But it appears that hundreds of thousands are dying. It started in just a half a dozen or fewer caves in the state of New York 2 winters ago, and by the end of last winter, it had spread across more than 4 states and 5 or 6 species.
Now, you said 100,000 bats, and this is really serious, and we talked earlier about some of the impact that bats have on the ecosystem. We didn't even mention that they also are credited with seed dispersal, pollination. Some people say, I've heard, that we would not have that agave plants would not thrive without bats, and that would mean that we would lose tequila, among other things, wouldn't we? Are they doing the same sorts of things that bees do and carrying pollen?
We're opening up several topics at once. Let's start with your first observation and work down through them. In New York, your most abundant bat that is most affected by white-nose syndrome, the one for which it is believed that not just 100,000 but as high as hundreds of thousands may have perished, these bats, just one of them can catch 1,000 mosquito-sized insects in an hour, and they're exceedingly beneficial in terms of just keeping insect populations in check. And then as you go to other parts of the world, yes, bats are critically important pollinators and seed dispersers of rainforests, which are literally the lungs and rainmakers of our planet. But you don't run into seed dispersing and pollinating bats until you get to the very southern part, southwestern part of the United States, where some of the giant cacti and agaves that people are so familiar with as keystone plants of the Southwest, these are heavily reliant on bats for pollination and sometimes for seed dispersal as well. You mentioned the agave. There are approximately 70 species of agaves between southern Arizona and southern Mexico. They're believed to rely heavily on bats as their primary pollinators. And in fact, the agave from which all tequila is made is heavily reliant on bats as its primary pollinators.
Mr. Tuttle, you told the New York Times a few years ago that it's vastly more dangerous to have dogs in your neighborhood than bats, and yet so many people are afraid of bats. Is it because they have heard of vampire bats, or is it just because bats look like flying mice?
Too often people are, you know, if you want to scare somebody about bats, you tell them that nearly all human rabies cases in America come from bats, and then you tell them that people can die without even knowing they're bitten, and it's very frightening. But let me put that in real light perspective. Rabies is by far the rarest public health reported disease in America. Bat rabies kills about 1.5 humans per year on average, and those people typically have carelessly handled a sick bat that may have bit them in self-defense. It is exceedingly unlikely that anybody is ever going to be attacked by a bat or bitten by a bat without knowing it. It is often reported that people get bitten without knowing it because in public health statistics, bats are, well, let me start first. In public health statistics, they only count data from people who can tell them personally what happened. But most people who die of rabies from any animal are dead or incoherent before they're diagnosed. So it's impossible for them to say, yes, I handled a bat or I did such and such. And so because we don't have an ability to confirm how they got rabies, we speculate too often that they got it from a bat that attacked them in their sleep or something and they didn't know about it. When I have looked into the backgrounds of these cases, in almost every one that is possible to carefully research, it turns out that somebody picked up a sick bat, the bat bit them in self-defense, and they didn't go to the doctor and check. Even if you're bitten by a sick bat, there's still plenty of time to be evaluated and take rabies vaccine, which is painless and highly effective.
WMIC News did a piece earlier in October about how New York City's bat population is doing, and we have a link to it posted on our show page at WNYC.org if you want to hear more. My great thanks to Merlin Tuttle, who's founder of Bat Conservation International. We didn't get a chance for me to ask you about bats in the belfry and blind as a bat, but maybe the next time you're on the show, we can address those other popular thoughts about bats. I do thank you so much for being with us today.